Away with Words, Part 3, Lecture 6, Pronouns and the Noun System.
In the previous lecture, we set out all the different parts of speech. A metaphor that I love, by the way. I think of like a little box full of parts of speech, like auto parts or something that you can assemble. But we're calling them word classes. And we went through the different things about them, and we're saving verbs till later. So we've covered the building blocks, the nouns and the verbs, the describing words, the adjectives and the adverbs, and the function words, the prepositions and the conjunctions that allow us to tie everything together. Now we get to the more complicated bits. So we're doing two things in this lecture. The first thing is we're adding the next word class, the one that makes English and many other languages even more versatile and better able to communicate complex ideas in a minimal amount of time. And these are the pronouns. And then we're going to tackle a few of the more common grammatical problems associated with both pronouns and nouns. And this includes irregular plurals, the difference between mass and count nouns, and a few other things that really bother people when they're writing or speaking, when they worry about their grammar. When they say to me, "Professor Drought, I better watch my grammar," we're starting now to get to the issues that people are really worried about here. First, we need to build up the other pieces of the system. And we'll start with pronouns. Now, a pronoun is actually a less descriptive and far less useful name than a noun. But again, we're really stuck with it. I see a theme. Nouns are okay, but not great names. Adjectives, adverbs are terrible. And pronouns, not so good either. I guess I should rewrite all the grammatical terms with my own names for them, but I don't think we're going to get there. Now, the traditional description is that a pronoun stands in for a noun. So instead of saying, "Professor Drought went to the store, and then Professor Drought left, and on Professor Drought's way out of the store, Professor Drought met a friend of Professor Drought's who hugged Professor Drought and said hello to Professor Drought, and Professor Drought's daughter, Professor Drought's daughter, was walking with Professor Drought," we instead can say, "Professor Drought went to the store, and then he left, and on his way out of the store, he met a friend of his who hugged him and said hello to him and his daughter, who was walking with him." Saves a lot of space. Seems very easy. Pronoun stands in for a noun. But in fact, except for the verbs, pronouns are possibly the most complex of the word classes. They actually give verbs a run for their money. And the reason is that there's not only a variety of different kinds of pronouns, but they also communicate important information and do a lot of subtle work. And they also have a deep and confusing history. So let's take them bit by bit. The overarching idea is fairly well represented by the traditional definition that a pronoun stands in for a noun. So pronouns allow us to replace a specific noun with some more general term. So far, so good, right? You heard that previous sentence, you saw how it worked. But English also allows us to cram a lot more information into a pronoun. We can let the reader know how the pronoun is linked to other words in the sentence and what role it's performing. And here's where things get complicated. So let's start by working up with the simplest pronouns and getting to the most complex ones. And the simplest pronouns are called the personal pronouns. I, me, we, us, you, they, them, he, she, and it. All of those fit in for the traditional definition of a pronoun. They stand in for a noun. So let's go back to my sample sentence. Every time I said Professor Drought, you substitute in he. Huge time saver. Makes the sentence seem much more elegant without all that repetition. And it's a lot less hideous, too. Why keep saying Professor Drought again and again and again? But look, even in my simple sentence, which I set up to illustrate the principles of substitution, there are some problems. You can't actually just sub in he for every instance of Professor Drought. Watch what happens when you do. Professor Drought went to the store, and then he left, and on he way out of the store, he met a friend of he who hugged he and said hello to he and he daughter. He daughter was walking with he. Ech, what happened? Why didn't the substitution work? Well, there's a simple explanation. Pronouns are one of the few parts of the English grammatical system that are still inflected, So see, I keep bringing up this word inflected, and I'm going to hammer you with it until you're like, oh, of course, they're inflected. What inflected means, again, is that you've done something to the actual word itself, oftentimes sticking an ending on, but also potentially changing something inside the word. That's the part I hadn't mentioned before. But we are changing the word because of the grammatical role it plays in the sentence. And this is what gets confusing and creates the problems. Remember that English is no longer mostly an inflected language. We use word order. We say the thing over here is the subject, the thing over here is the object, there's the verb in the middle. But in Old English, all those little endings were there. Well, the pronoun system has remained very conservative. Certain things have changed. We even picked up a new pronoun here or there from Old Norse. And the pronouns have changed in terms of the way they're pronounced. But the overall pronoun system goes way, 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 way back, and they're still inflected. So, we have to change the word based on the role it's playing in the sentence. When we indicate that something is receiving action, that is, it's an object, which we'll discuss much more in a couple of lectures, we have to use the word him rather than he, or her rather than she. Pronouns are inflected for number. That's the difference between I and we, or he and she and they, right? One is singular, one's plural. They're inflected for gender, him and he versus her and she. And they are also inflected for subject and object function. And this is the trickiest part. That's he versus him and she versus her. Then we also have a whole pile of possessive pronouns like his, her, and its that act a lot like adjectives, but they are also possessive pronouns. And this makes the pronoun system tricky to navigate. It makes it tricky to navigate, I'll add, even for native speakers. So if you're coming to this right now, if you're listening because you're learning English as a second language and you're working to improve your grammar, you can feel pretty good because the native speakers, the people who grew up speaking English since they were 1 year old, still have some problems with pronouns. One of the biggest traditional grammar problems that I mark on my student papers are called pronoun antecedent agreement. Now, I have this sinking feeling right now that thousands of first-year writing teachers across the country are writing pronoun antecedent agreement on the papers, and the students are reading pronoun antecedent agreement problem, but really all the students are getting is blah, 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 I got a red mark. Here's the problem. Most people don't think about what an antecedent means. They don't link it to pronouns. They don't know why they've got something wrong on their paper. This is, by the way, why I think you should not mark pronoun antecedent agreement if you're an English teacher. Mark singular plural mismatch. It's what I write. I know it takes a little bit longer, but then you don't have to write the word antecedent, and you'll explain a little more to your students. So we solve the quick problem with this by reminding ourselves what an antecedent is. One of the reasons that people have a problem is when they hear antecedent, they think A-N-T-I, anti, against, when it's actually A-N-T-E, ante, meaning before, like an anteroom, not that we actually use that word very much, or an antechamber, which means like before the room or before the chamber. An antecedent is something that comes before. And what that means, it's the noun that comes before the pronoun. So if we go back to my sample sentence, Professor Drought went to the store and then he left. The antecedent is Professor Drought, and the pronoun is he. And this is the other problem in traditional grammar, because it's called pronoun antecedent agreement, but the antecedent actually comes first. And I think that's just why it messes people up, because they're reading pronoun antecedent, but the antecedent actually comes before the pronoun, but we've said pronoun first. It just creates huge confusion. Now, pronoun antecedent agreement is pretty straightforward. It is simply matching up the various characteristics of the pronoun with the antecedent, with the thing that the pronoun is substituting in for. So in my sample sentence, right, if I say Professor Drought went to the store, I have to substitute in he rather than they or she. I mean, really, this is not too much of a problem, right? Professor Drought is masculine, or at least I think so, and singular, except when I hear the multiple voices in my head, and therefore it has to be he and not they or she. But this is not always easy to do in writing, and we get this problem in pronoun antecedent agreement due to the structure of the English pronoun system. My students are always getting marked off for saying things like, the reader will find that they enjoy the book. Out comes Grady Mordax, my grading pen. What, you don't have a grading pen that's named? Well, I do. It means grade biter in Latin, by the way. And I write a comment. But again, I don't write pronoun antecedent agreement just because I'm better than that. No, just because I don't think students get it. I write singular plural mismatch. And this is where the problem occurs. Reader is a singular, but they is a plural. What are you supposed to do? Many, many people have this problem, and many, many grammar pedants like me mark it. Here's the problem. The pronoun has to be the same number and gender as the antecedent. This is just to keep things clear, right? If you're talking about Professor Drought and then you say it, well, I'm probably going to be offended. And if you say they, I'm going to be confused. Likewise, then, if you're talking about the reader, that's a singular. You need a singular pronoun. But here's where the problem comes in. English does not have a non-gendered third-person singular pronoun. We just go over that. English does not have a non-gendered, meaning if you don't know whether it's male or female, or it's generic in some sense, but you do know it's a person, right? We can't use it about people. We can't say, the reader will find that it enjoys the book. I guess if we're like the bad guy in Silence of the Lambs saying, it puts the lotion in the basket. But that's a deliberate dehumanization of someone. We don't do that. We don't say it. So we need to have some kind of form to match up, and we just don't have one in English. English didn't have one. Why? History. It didn't have one because English used to have much more grammatical gender. That is, there were masculine nouns and there were feminine nouns that weren't about real gender in any sense, like, you know, I don't know, a lamp. Is it masculine or feminine? In German, you have to pick. Every single noun in German, you have to pick whether it's masculine or feminine and use the appropriate article. Well, Old English was sort of like that. Masculine words got se in front of them, and feminine words got seo, and the grammar matched up. And so therefore, you didn't need a gender-neutral third-person pronoun because everything was gendered in one way or the other. But when that gendering was lost, we didn't pick up one. Now, the old school answer was called the universal he. And so you would say something like, the reader will find that he will enjoy the book. Now, there are two problems with this. The first is very straightforward. You've suddenly imported a gender for something that didn't have a gender. So let's forget about politics for a second and just look at this on straight logical grounds. You've said the reader. It's generic. It's deliberately not picking out any specific reader. As soon as you say he, you're saying it's a male reader. But it wasn't. That's actually the linguistic and grammatical argument for not using that universal he. The political argument is that since the 1970s, people have tried to work on non-sexist grammar. Now, I'm not convinced that changing all the he's in the world to he or she really reduces actual sexism at all. It's now a good idea because it comes off as very, very jarring if you go one gender or the other, especially because people have become heightened to this. But again, I don't think it's really the political issue as much as it is straightforwardly a logical issue. If you're saying generic, then you shouldn't turn it into gendered because the whole point is to make it be any reader. So what do you do? Well, the first thing is that you don't play gotcha with other people when they mess up on this. It's one thing for me to do it when I'm grading my students or when you are grading your students. But, you know, if someone messes up and says the reader, they, you know, kind of give them a break, though I have to admit that I feel like the reader, they, is sort of a barbarism. It just is very grating to me, and I think that that's one of the places we actually should draw the line. So here I'm sounding like an anything-goes kind of guy about prepositions at the end of the sentence or conjunctions at the beginning of the sentence, but I really don't think we should use they to indicate generic singular. And there's a reason for that. It's not just that I'm, you know, a priss about the whole thing. It's that they is a plural. If you don't mean more than one reader, then don't use a plural pronoun. In other words, you're kind of caught in a contradiction. If you use he, you're gendering. If you use she, it's jarring. If you use they, you're making a plural not match with a singular. So what do you do? Well, if you absolutely have to, you can use he or she, but please don't use other barbarisms like S/HE, which isn't even a readable word in English. My recommendation, what I try to teach my students to do, is pluralize the antecedent. You can make like little bumper stickers or something. Pluralize the antecedent. So instead of saying, the reader will find that he likes the book, change it to readers will find that they like the book. Readers is absolutely just as generic as the reader. It means any group of readers, and then you can use they, and you can avoid English's big flaw of not having a third-person non-gendered pronoun. Problem solved. Make the antecedent agree with the pronoun by pluralizing both of them. One other related problem shows up in speaking rather than writing. English no longer has a second-person plural distinct from the first-person plural in the second person. Again, in the second person, we use you for both. This isn't such a big deal in writing, but when you're addressing a group of people, are you speaking to one of them, or are you speaking to all of them? Now, in many places in America, we have y'all. Y'all works great to indicate the plural from the singular, but this is a dialect form, and in certain circumstances, it won't help you at all, and you can't really use it in writing anyway. We have yuns, if you live in the Pittsburgh area. So there's you, singular, and yuns, plural, which is a contraction of yuns or something like that. And if you're from the Philadelphia, New Jersey area like me, we would say you and yous. I always think of my uncle looking at my cousin and I and saying, yous are so stupid about something or another. But really, that's sad to say, to admit about my own beloved New Jersey dialect. This is not a prestige form, and you would not look good using it. So finally, most people in the Northeast of America use you guys. However, oftentimes people from the South, particularly women, will be offended by this usage, saying, you guys, I'm not a guy. So what we really need is a new pronoun, but English is not inventing them. Now, why don't we have a distinction between the singular and the plural for the second person, for you? Well, the history behind this is kind of interesting. Old English had a pronoun ye, which was you, and it had another pronoun thou, which is thou, and that indicated different numbers in the second person. Thou was singular, one person, thou, and ye was plural, indicated multiple ones. However, in the 13th century, the th forms, thou, thy, and thee, became familiar forms. They were used to indicate solidarity, to indicate that you're talking to either a social inferior or children or close friends. And the polite form became the you, your form. Now, in many languages, this is just fine. There's the French forms of this. In Russian, you have ti versus vui, and there's no problem. You use them in different circumstances. But in English, for whatever reason, using thou in a formal situation marked you as being a bore or being deliberately rude. There's actually some Shakespearean jokes of this effect. In Twelfth Night, Sir Toby Belch is encouraging Sir Andrew Aguecheek to write an insulting letter and says, if thou thou'st him some thrice, it shall not be amiss. In other words, use the word thou rather than the word you three times and you'll really be rude. These thou forms then disappeared from polite speech and then eventually disappeared from speech entirely, though they hung on in America among the Quakers for ideological reasons. The Quakers believed you should address everyone with the familiar form rather than the whole politeness thing. But we no longer had thou, which was considered rude, and so we had to make do with you filling both the singular and the plural roles. And this is why we have some problems in English, because our pronoun system evolved, but we haven't added any new pronouns. Some people have tried. Some authors have tried to import German sie, S-I-E, to indicate non-gendered for third person. Some people have tried with yuns or y'all, but it's not happening. We're not bringing in any new pronouns. Languages just don't usually take in new pronouns. The last time English took in a new pronoun was back at the time of the Danish invasions. so I wouldn't really count on it happening anytime soon. Okay, that takes care of the personal pronouns, but we also have to deal with the demonstrative pronouns. And these are pronouns that point out or demonstrate particular nouns. The most important demonstratives are this, that, these, and those. And this was immortalized by my high school Russian teacher, Dr. Cassie, as dis, dat, dies, and does. He would say in a very good Brooklyn accent that I can't do. Dis, dat, dies, and does are demonstratives. Now, some grammarians, I happen to be one of them, would include what we call the articles among the demonstratives. That's the and also. This is exactly what I do in my Old English Grammar book, King Alfred's Grammar, because it actually simplifies things. Rather than separating out articles from demonstratives, you just say they're all demonstratives. They point to something. The cow, the red panda, a red panda, that red panda, those red pandas. You see, demonstratives work by showing the relationship between the speaker and the things that he's talking about. The obviously usually indicates a specific individual thing, while a means something like a member of some kind of grouping. Now, this is the whole definite and indefinite article thing, a nightmare for people learning English as a second language. There's really not any perfectly clear rules, and it's one of those things that you end up picking up bit by bit, whether things are the or a. But I will say that the general rule, specific versus general, works, and also, it's not as bad as it is in German, where you have to figure out the gender of every noun. So, you can thank your lucky stars for that. My biggest hint for dealing with grammar errors associated with the demonstrative is this. Although this and that can stand on their own, they're demonstrative pronouns, they can just stand there in the sentence, it's better for reading comprehension if they don't stand on their own. And here's the reason. Let's say that you're talking and you talk about this. You can point at whatever this is. So when I'm talking about this and this right here, this is no good. You have no idea what I'm talking about unless you're seeing that I'm pointing at the spot on the wall or the hole in the carpet or something like that. In writing, you're not there to help explain that to the person who's listening. And therefore, if you just use this or that without a noun after it, the person's not going to get as much of your point. So here's a completely mindless tip. Drought's mindless tips for improving your writing. I love mindless tips because I don't have to think about them. I can just do them when I'm tired or bored and just improving my paper. Go to your word processor and hit Command F for find and type in this. Find every this in your document and make sure it has a noun after it. Almost any noun, even if you just put like this phenomenon or this fact, anything will do to improve your reading comprehension. It's a little tip, but it actually goes a long way to making you think clearly, because if you can't just say this, but you have to say what the this is, it ties your writing together more. I talk about this a lot more in my recorded books course, Away with Words, which is about writing, rhetoric, and the arts of persuasion. But that's a tip that you can use right there. Now, there's also reflexive pronouns, which are usually created by adding the word self to the end of a pronoun. So we get himself, herself, itself. And reflexives are generally not problematic. I'm just bringing them up because in a couple of lectures, I'm going to show you how to use reflexives as a weasel trick to get out of subject-object difficulties. But just remember, the reflexives are the ones with self, and they go back to themselves. And finally, there are the relative pronouns. Who, whom, and which. And these were my nemesis in Mrs. Stiller's 8th grade English class. But they're immensely important for English. The relative pronoun takes the second part of the sentence and makes it relative, related to the first part. So if we say, that is my favorite store, which sells vintage Star Wars toys, or she went to the store that sells Star Wars toys, or she went to the Star Wars store, which is open on Thursdays. We're using relative pronouns. Relative pronouns are related to the dreaded who, whom, and which, that problems, which we'll deal with in a few subsequent lectures. But for now, just note that a relative pronoun indicates that a phrase or clause is going to modify or describe some other noun in the sentence. They are relative to each other. Now, I think you see the immense complexity of the pronoun system in English. It's the way it is because although English itself turned into a basic analytic language, in which word order makes a real difference, the pronoun system was conserved, not even from the early Anglo-Saxon period, but really going back to Indo-European. The pronoun system is mostly, or in a large part, conserved, if you can just trace the sound changes. And with some exceptions, and the biggest being that we imported she and they from Old Norse, the grammatical distinctions that were made in the Anglo-Saxon period are still around today. And that's why pronouns are difficult to learn if you're picking up English as a second language. There are just so many more ways to mess them up than there are ways to mess up nouns or other parts of speech except for verbs. But I'm belaboring this because the pronouns in their various forms, they're one of the main areas where people are worried about their grammar. In the particular, the decision of when to say me rather than I, or whom versus who. And for the explanation of that to make sense, we have to build up a few other things. Otherwise, I'm just giving you rules rather than giving you explanation. But we will get to that, and I will show you exactly how to know when to use me and when to use I. And that's a big payoff, but the bigger payoff is understanding how the system works. Okay, those are the pronouns. Now, we're going to pick up a few things about the nouns that often mess up people's grammar, sometimes making things hard to understand, but more often just making things seem wrong or inelegant or because it's not following some relatively arbitrary distinctions. And this is the distinction between count nouns and mass nouns. I know your hearts can barely contain themselves when I'm talking about count nouns and mass nouns. But it's my experience from teaching literature and teaching writing that a lot of people get really flustered and worry and think they have bad grammar when they come upon this distinction between mass nouns and count nouns. And actually what they do is they come upon individual count nouns or mass nouns, and then they have to do something to those nouns, and then they panic. So take, for example, this paper that I just graded yesterday on the train on my way down to record this lecture. The student mentions that a character in one of the books we have read has a large amount of problems. This is grammatically wrong. And this is one of the things that a teacher will flag you for. And I'll even bet that the student had a feeling that it was wrong, but didn't know what to do and just went ahead and put it in there, which, by the way, is the right thing to do. Better than falling into analysis paralysis and not knowing. Just at least stick it in, then you can fix it later when you revise. But so what's wrong with saying someone has a large amount of problems? Now, this is the distinction between mass nouns and count nouns. Count nouns are easy to conceptualize. You have lots of individual units. Mass nouns are trickier. It's a big lump of something. So, for example, you can count things like pandas or cows or rooms or fish, but it's much harder to count things like butter, music, or sewage. It's also hard to count things that are immaterial, like freedom or intelligence. The problem comes, and we have to think about these distinctions, because English wants us to quantify count nouns with words like one, a few, several, or 1,208. But mass nouns have to be qualified, modified, with things like an X amount of, or a Y volume of, or much, or little. So if we go back to that student's large amount of problems, we see the problem. Problems are count nouns. They're individual things. You can say, well, I have this problem, I have the next problem, I have the third problem, I have the fourth problem. If you say amount, you're not describing individual things. So you've created a grammatical infelicity. And again, I may be an anything-goes guy when it comes to prepositions at the end of the sentence, but I am very rigid on this infelicity because you don't want to give your readers conflicting information. If you say amount, the next thing they're expecting is a mass noun. If you say amount, the next thing they're expecting is a mass noun. And if you disappoint them in some way, you'll confuse them and they won't understand. Now, English also deals with mass nouns in really complex ways. For example, bread is a mass noun, just bread in general, all or any bread. So if we want to talk about it in specific to make it into a count noun, we have to supply some additional information like a loaf of bread. Now it's a count noun, a loaf of bread, seven loaves of bread, four loaves of bread, and so forth. We can't say seven bread. We can say seven breads, but that indicates maybe different types of bread. But we can say much bread or little bread. These distinctions, by the way, can be really tough to keep track of because many words can be both mass nouns and count nouns depending on the context. So if you say, for example, I bought three cakes, Those are count nouns. But I had a lot of cake. That's a mass noun. Mary had a little lamb. A count noun. Lamb is tasty with mint jelly. A mass noun. It even gets worse because theoretically and logically, mass nouns, since they're uncountable, shouldn't even deal with singular and plural. But unfortunately, the grammar system forces us to choose either singular or plural for all nouns, including mass nouns. So think about this. Weeds is a mass noun, but it's in the plural. Ashes, sweets, and pants. By the way, this last one drives people crazy and caused the invention, and I mean invention, of the horrible word pant, without the S, written by catalog writers who really got tired of writing pair of pants again and again and again and again. There was not a pant, and then it was pluralized as pants. It was pants. Another trick that the grammar does is to try to pull out bits of mass nouns so we can deal with them as if they're count nouns. We use piece and we use bit to do this. So that's a nice piece of stupidity. Stupidity, mass noun, piece of it, count noun. Good bit of hitting there. Hitting, mass noun, bit, count noun. Terrible piece of luck. We also have what are called collectives, which are things like the state or family or nation. The problem is that some collectives are treated as singulars while others are treated as plurals. So if you say, family is very important to me, that's a singular. If you say, the police is one of the key institutions in society, and notice how that doesn't feel quite right because you have police, which sounds like a plural, followed by is. But if you're talking about generic police, that's technically correct, though I would never write that sentence because it sounds bad. But you can take the same nouns and put them in the plural. All my family votes in the elections. Or the police are given difficult assignments. Those are both plurals. What do we do with such a mess? How do you fix it? I mean, that's what you're really after right now. Well, the key in writing and speaking is to try to remember if the noun you're modifying is mass or count. And if you can do this, and all you have to do is picture the noun, lots of individual bits or a big whole, then you can choose how to treat it properly. But we have to acknowledge this is really difficult for people coming to English as a second language because a lot of it's based on convention. You know, you can imagine lots and lots of sticks of butter, but butter itself is a mass noun. And it's also difficult for native speakers because they're dealing with concepts like problems that you can't easily picture. I mean, you can imagine a whole herd of cows or a big pile of dead squirrels, but you can't really find a stack of problems. It doesn't give the same mental image. So we have to just acknowledge that mass nouns and count nouns are a pain, and there's one other big pain associated with nouns, and those are nouns that have irregular plurals. Because pluralization is usually very easy in English compared to some other languages. Just add S. Word gets S, we get a plural, yay, simplicity done! But there are quite a number of words in English that do not add the S. And once again, the reason is history. Some of these words change the vowel in the stem of the word, and others don't even change anything. Now let's explain where this comes from. There's actually a few roots. One is Greek and Latin. Greek and Latin do add letters for plurals, but they don't add S. So when Greek and Latin words come into the language, you have problems there. But the other group are the irregular plurals that change the vowel inside the word instead of putting an ending on. And these are nouns that go all the way back to Proto-Indo-European and Anglo-Saxon. And instead of adding on an S, they changed their stem vowel. Tooth becomes teeth, foot becomes feet, and so on. Goose, geese, mouse, mice, tooth, teeth, foot, feet, all strong plurals. But some words that you'd think would follow the strong plurals usually don't, which is how I brought up before, moose and meese. We don't say that. But we also don't want to say mooses, which would be normal. Why? Because we don't like to double the S at the end of words to make a plural. So if you had a word that ends in S, there's usually some other way of doing it. We don't want to say moose, mooses. We can't say moose, meese. So what do? We just leave the word alone, call it moose, moose, and let the context take care of it. And usually that'll work because in a rule that we're going to call conservation of S later on, we can tell if something is singular or plural based on the verb. So we're okay with that. I actually have a favorite strong plural, which I'll just tell you quickly. And that's the use of en, which is an Old English plural. We really only see it in oxen anymore. And really, how often are we talking about oxen? Now, I want to propose applying this old plural to the problem of how to refer to multiple players on the Boston Red Sox. Technically, you would say something like members of the Red Sox. But if you want to talk about one player, it sounds very weird to say, like, Jacoby Ellsbury is a Red Sock. He's not a single sock. How do we do that? So I propose keeping Red Sox as singular. Manny Ramirez is a Red Sox. But when we want to talk about more than one of them, let's use the Old English plural and talk about the Red Soxen, who won the 2004 and 2007 World Series. Okay, maybe not. Greek and Latin gets a little more tricky, if only because people in general don't know how the system works and they make guesses. And I'm not going to belabor this, but I have to talk really briefly about octopi. Because when I was growing up, I was taught that the proper plural of octopus was octopi. And I thought it was. And then recently, I started to see people writing octopuses. And I'm like, what morons? Language has really gone downhill when people are saying octopuses. Then, because I'm a philologist, I investigated it. It turns out that people who write octopuses are probably right. Octopi is wrong, and here's why. Octopus is not a Latin word. It's a Greek word. If it was a Latin word, then it would be ending in US. And if you remember anything from alumnus, alumni, there's lots of words in Latin that have the Latin plural of I. US going to I, which by the way in Latin is pronounced E, but we're not going to go into that. But the end of octopus is not actually a U.S., it's P-U-S. It's pus, which means foot. And the plural of a pus word in Greek would not be pie. It would probably be something like poi. So the proper plural would be like octopoi. Well, no one's going to use that. And so you get rid of this fake Latin plural, octopi, and it really has to be either just octopus, octopus, like moose, moose, or it has to be octopus, octopuses. However, the kind of people who regularly use Latin plurals are not about to have their minds changed about this, so we can see a great controversy between octopi and octopuses. The key thing to take away from this entire lecture is that there are some real complexities about the noun-pronoun system, but that you can figure them out. You turn that understanding around and then produce correct grammar on your own. Well, that's not always easy, but it will come with practice, and more important, with thinking about grammar. It will come. Now, in our next few lectures, we're going to move from the nouns and the pronouns to the verbs, where the action is. And then finally, we'll have what we need to make some sentences. You never realize it would take so much to build up such seemingly simple building blocks. But there is this payoff at the end of the drought way. You'll understand why you're doing what you're doing. And so if you make mistakes, you'll know why they're mistakes, and then you'll learn about them and fix them more easily.
This ends Lecture 6. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399 and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.